So the way that it worked for us was that our analysts were working on DBT models in general. As I said, there were some like bizarrely specific Python models that some people built, but 99% of the time we were working with these SQL models. But what we did, we pre-invented a much worse version of that, like back in the past. Obviously, you guys have done it better than us, but we pre-invented our own version of it. The idea was that in CI, we would take all of the model definitions, generate all of the SQL for them, and then that's what Airflow would actually end up running. And you'd also create from that a definition of the DAG that Airflow could consume. So that's the kind of the mapping bit that's interesting.
You're listening to the Data Flowcast, where we unlock the secrets of mastering Airflow for data engineering and AI.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Data Flowcast. I'm your host, Mark Lomberti, and I'm super excited because today I'm joined by Jonathan Rayner, staff engineer at Apollo GraphQL, previously data platform engineer at Monzo Bank. So how are you doing, Jonathan?
Hey, thank you very much for having me. It's really great to be here. Yeah, doing well. It's always this kind of period in the kind of wind down to Christmas when you suddenly realize everything you have to get done before you wind down. And so we're in that kind of crazy period at the moment, but that's life sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel you. But I actually haven't prepared anything yet, so maybe I should. All right, so let's dive in. For today's podcast, we will discuss about DAG consistency issues, UI scaling challenges. Honestly, this one for me is really interesting, because when we talk about scaling issues, we always tend to think about resources like memory and CPU, but actually, how do you use the UI when you have thousands of tasks? That is something that you need to take into consideration. Then how to monitor Airflow at scale and some practical lessons that you learned through your journey with Airflow at scale. So maybe we could start with some background, like what did you do at Monzo Bank as a data platform engineer?
Yeah, cool. So essentially, I was part of the data platform engineering team at Monzo. And so the idea was we were responsible for the ingestion of data from all of our microservices and from the phone apps that we had deployed, the processing of that into raw events that we could use via Airflow, and then also the Airflow instance that ran the models created by our data analysts and that kind of thing. And then also we had a tangential responsibility for our Looker instance as well, which is running all of our kind of BI visualizations and that kind of thing. So it was very much the pipeline end to end, but we were very clear that we were trying to be responsible for giving our data analysts a platform to run models on rather than being responsible for the content of those models specifically. So that was very much where we were situated. So Airflow for us very much sat right in the middle of that. So we had raw tables at one end, and then our analysts would create DBT models that would transform those raw events into various derived data products. And then Airflow was really the workhorse that was scheduling all of the compute we needed. So we very much used Airflow as a scheduling tool. So we weren't running big compute intensive computation inside of it, but we were very much using it to schedule computation within BigQuery mostly. We had a couple of like custom Python workloads that we ran that did actually run inside of Airflow itself in some sense. But most of it was outsourced to BigQuery and so we were using it as a scheduling mechanism essentially for those things.
Okay, that's interesting. Did you try to run things within Airflow, or did you just wanted to use it as a scheduler?
So it was quite an interesting kind of philosophical question almost that we tried to answer. Because when I was at the Airflow Summit in 2023, I remember there being this kind of interesting point where this came up in one of the panels and someone was like, oh, maybe it should just be a compute platform. Maybe it should be just a scheduling platform. It's interesting. I think a lot of that came from the history of where the data warehouse at Monzo came from originally. So it started out in the kind of pre-DBT days as like hand-stitched together SQL that existed. And so in most cases, because the data models were all expressed as SQL models, it made sense for them to just be things that were run in BigQuery. There wasn't a lot of heavy-duty Python processing or any of the kind of things you find in some other data pipelines. So for us, that kind of made sense because of the kind of things we were processing. But I can see in a world where if your lingua franca is Python, if you're running machine learning models, whatever else, then I can see why you might want to schedule that within Airflow itself. But I think it's interesting that Airflow allows you to take both views and isn't that opinionated on the way you want to go with it. So for us, it made sense for it to be just a scheduler, but that mostly is a sort of historical thing about where our models lived and the kind of models that our analysts wanted to build.
That's a very good point. I actually, at the beginning, I was extremely, like, I was very opinionated on the fact that you should not use Airflow as a way to run your task, but really use it as an orchestrator. I think I changed my opinion a little bit. As long as you know what you are doing, to your point, Airflow has this flexibility to offer you both ways. Yeah. Ultimately, it's up to you to know what should be the best for you.
I think it's an interesting, I think it is interesting because I think one of the problems that starts to arise is you then start having to use Airflow to consider things. In our case, we are running a top Kubernetes, so we're running our own kind of installation of it. So you then have to start, if you then start to use it to run compute directly within Airflow, you then have to start considering things like, do I need my analyst to understand that, you know, this particular task needs resources for some reason, this particular one needs GPUs. So you just end up with a much more complicated, or you can end up with a much more complicated kind of abstraction at the top level. But it also depends upon, but it depends upon so many dynamics, including things like your analyst level of experience. Like some of them understand all this stuff, and other people are just, I wrote some Python, just run it for me, I don't care. Like it's on a continuum somewhere, right?
Yeah, that's true. That's very true. Great. So I guess, like, You said a little bit about that, but what does your team use Airflow for when you were at Monzo Bank? Like, maybe if you have one use case in mind, because I imagine that you were using Airflow for many different use cases, but if you have one in mind.
Yeah.
And with some numbers as well, just to...
Oh, okay. Yeah, no. Totally. So the big use case that we had for Airflow was our nightly DAG that we ran. So this is a DAG that runs every 24 hours. It kicks off at 1 a.m. And the idea, or the ideal, was that it would be finished processing the sort of 8 or 9 most significant models that we had by 9 o'clock in the morning, so that it was ready for analysts to come in and do their work at 9. That was the idea. So these were models like things that banks care a lot about, transactions, accounts, kind of stuff. So these are big models. And we're talking about, and so they're big models themselves, but also we're talking about a DAG with 8,000 or so tasks in it. It's probably more now. It was about 8,000 when I left. It's probably more now. But so you're talking about something quite big, essentially, to work. So a lot of it was, so that was one use case, was just doing the number crunching of working out what do all our accounts look like, what balances do people have, all that kind of stuff. But then there were also other use cases in there. So doing things like creating feature sets for our machine learning classifiers was another thing that we used it for. And also even things like credit scoring, like you're building probabilistic scoring models and then using that. Even though everything was mediated around these big SQL models, that what they were actually used and pushed into in many cases was quite different. The big, and to be honest, oftentimes the biggest consumer of that was our Looker BI instance, essentially. So we're trying to create models that you can therefore give insight to non-technical stakeholders. So a lot of our biggest dashboards were being served directly to leadership and that kind of thing. So there were some models, particularly around things like liquidity, that are really important that you get right, because obviously if you're a bank and you're not solvent, that's not particularly great. There's a sort of, there are interesting constraints on certain models around correctness and that kind of thing. I guess the other big constraint, or the other big use case for us, was regulatory reporting. So it's a big thing. Again, with being a bank, a big thing you've got to get right. A lot of the regulators have very particular formats that they want data in, and very particular kinds of data. And they also have very specific restrictions about if you say you're being audited, if they come in and say you're being audited on a specific day, you have to have the data to them by a specific time on that day. So it's a very specific format. And it has to be, because that's what you've got to be regulated in these industries. That makes sense. But so that was another big deal for us, with making sure that when our pipelines were running, we were getting the right data. So if an audit were to happen at very short notice, it would not be a problem to compute the data required. So those are a couple of the use cases that we had in mind for it.
This is awesome. So I guess, like, it is safe to say that Airflow was pretty critical for us, for you.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. It was something, especially in the world of regulatory reporting, where the penalties for getting that wrong were very high. It was the kind of thing where if you were being paged about it at 6 a.m. or even earlier, you weren't like, I'm just going to put my phone down, that's fine. No, you were on your laptop at whatever time of the morning to get it fixed. It was very important stuff.
Okay. Yeah, I see. So I guess when you are running Airflow at that scale, you mentioned that you had to run thousands of tasks. And by the way, you said models. Are you talking about dbt models or just like SQL?
Yeah. So this is important. This is a bit of an important nuance to draw out, because there was a bit of a difference. So the way that it worked for us was that our analysts were working on dbt models in general. As I said, there were some like bizarrely specific Python models that some people built, but 99% of the time we were working with these SQL models. But what we did we pre-invented a much worse version of that, like back in the past. So we obviously, you guys have done it better than us, but we pre-invented our own version of it. The idea was that in CI, we would take all of the model definitions, generate all of the SQL for them, and then that's what Airflow would actually end up running. And you'd also create from that a definition of the DAG that Airflow could consume. So that's the kind of the mapping bit that's interesting. So 99% of the time when I say task and model, they're interchangeable, but there is that weird little subtlety about the Python models. So it's not quite as precise as I might like it to be.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thank you for the distinction. So I guess, like, just to cycle back on the number of tasks that you were running, did you have any issues like running so many tasks?
Yeah. So there's a whole host of issues that threw up, as you can imagine. So
yeah,
from the perspective of, as we've already alluded to in the introduction, the perspective of certain components of Airflow not scaling particularly well for that size of DAG in particular. This is also to say that we weren't just running a one single DAG. There were multiple DAGs, but the nightly one being the largest was the biggest problem that we had. And so there was that kind of technical thing, but it also, there was also a kind of more conceptual problem in the sense that so much of monitoring Airflow is built around the idea that you can use the UI to observe what's going on in your DAG, and also that the reasoning element can be done by a human by inspection. There's kind of this is never written down in any of the Airflow documentation, but it is in a kind of assumption that gets made as you go along. So when we started having issues around DAGs being in inconsistent states, that was hard to track down initially because so much of that isn't a problem when your DAG is only, say, 20 things in size. You can easily see if that's consistent or not. But for us, it was much harder to track that kind of thing down. And so we had to start thinking about how do we convert some of these kind of human insights into metrics rather than thinking about it from a kind of insight levels. Yeah, there were multiple different issues that operating at that kind of scale started to give us.
And I guess it is interesting because you just mentioned consistency. Can you define what do you mean by DAG consistency?
Yeah. So if we think about DAG consistency comes from the idea of task consistency. So that's the place to start. Obviously, in the Airflow documentation, we talk about tasks. And obviously, we have the nice state diagram that says tasks move from this state to this state. And that's how they do it. And that's what it means and all that kind of stuff. Obviously, for an individual task to be in a particular state, all of its upstreams should be also in a specific state. For example, it should be impossible for a task to be in a successful state if a task upstream of it is in a waiting state, because obviously it doesn't make any sense. How could it be successful if it's still waiting for something? So the one that was interesting to us was if a task is in an upstream failed state, then it must have an upstream that has failed. That's, again, by definition, is pretty obvious. Yep. What we meant by DAG consistency is to say that every task in the DAG is in a consistent state, by which we mean that the state the task is an accurate reflection of the upstreams that it has and the downstreams, most of the upstreams. And so the way that manifested for us is that what we would start to find is we would occasionally end up with the throughput in the DAG going down to zero. So nothing was executing because we had tasks that were in an upstream failed state, but nothing upstream had actually failed. And so this was really hard to detect because from the DAG run's point of view, everything is fine. Like it's still executing. Nothing is wrong in some sense. From our point of view, throughput's gone down to zero. No, nothing is executing. And the DAG run's effectively stuck. Like it can't do anything because it can't resolve this inconsistency. Because the DAG shouldn't be allowed to get into that state, and yet, seemingly it does. So those are the kind of problems that we started encountering.
Wow. Okay. That is very interesting. So I guess I have so many questions. So the first thing is, the first question that I have to you is, how did you find out that you were having those issues? Because to your point, like when you have like thousands of tasks, and I guess like maybe looking at the UI might not be easy, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that was definitely the case. So a lot of it, there's a flippant answer to this, and there's a more serious one. The flippant answer is we kept being pulled into incidents, but this kept being a problem especially because we had a kind of implicit time limit where it's like, if this stuff's done after 9 o'clock, that's a real issue. As soon as we started getting to the point where you'd get to say like 10:30, 11, and nothing had happened for a significant period of time, that was where then you'd start to then inspect the DAG yourself and be like, oh, hold on a minute, this doesn't really make any sense. but you're very much applying kind of human intuition on top of the data model that Airflow gives you, essentially. So the way that we started to effectively see it was we get pulled into these incidents, and then in these incidents, you'd go and start to look at the set of upstream, the set of failed tasks, and then you'd start to go look at their upstreams and compare that to then what Airflow is telling you is an upstream failed state. And then the sets would be disjoint, and you'd be like, hold on, that doesn't make any sense. How can it be an upstream failed state if it's not upstream of a failed thing? That doesn't make any sense at all. And so for a while, we dealt with it manually, basically. We would find the inconsistent ones and clear the task with downstreams, and that would start to resolve the problem. Because that was relatively easy to do, and it doesn't require a huge amount of kind of intelligence. But this happened quite a lot. There was a point where it was happening, I think it was happening nearly every day that we ran the DAG. And so this was getting to be ridiculous after a while. We then started to look at it and think, hold on a minute. Is there a way we could automate any of this? Could we start to build something that would actually solve this for us? And also, I think to probably address at this point, what we were seeing, as far as we could tell, is some problem with the way that Airflow does task state updates. And so we think, although this isn't based on a huge amount of data because it was very hard to capture exactly what was going on, but we were pretty sure that what was happening was when Airflow was trying to clear a lot of tasks at the same time, the order of events would be something like a task in the DAG failed quite early on and it's got a lot of downstreams. Mm-hmm. So when Airflow is trying to set the state of all of those downstreams to cleared, especially if one of those downstreams is also downstream of something else in that same set, you can end up in a sort of lost update problem where instead of it being upstream failed, cleared, it ends up being upstream failed, cleared, upstream failed. And obviously that's incorrect. So obviously that's an issue with Airflow, but because of the fact that it was very hard to get the bug to reproduce in any sensible way. We couldn't create a minimal example. It was the proposition of going to the Airflow community and being like, hey, we have this really ill-defined thing that we're not really sure if it's a problem or not. It was a very hard sell. We were like, okay, let's see what we can do in the shorter term to fix this. And so we built something that could do this consistency scanning for us, because all we were doing is graph algorithms. And this is computer science 101. This is back in the day, easy stuff. We built a service that could do that. And initially started it in just reporting mode. So just tell us if there's a consistency issue. And then we moved on to actually compute a solution and then run the solution through properly. So those were the steps were initially do it manually a couple of times and then go on from there. How can we build in a kind of automated process to make this more consistent? Obviously the real solution would be let's go fix this properly in Airflow, but it was very much a case of we need a solution to this quickly. And also it was a case of also at the time there were issues, not anymore, fortunately, but there were issues with us being stuck on older versions of Airflow for lots of other unrelated reasons. So it was like, even if we do get a fix in the upstream, we can't even necessarily take it at this point because of these other issues. So it was very much a kind of like, how do we build something that can solve this problem for us? We don't have to make big changes to Airflow at the current time, but that was the route we took.
Okay. So I guess, were you actually able to ultimately fix that issue, or you had to?
So we built a solution that worked, and in my last couple of months, it saved us about 11 or 12 incidents, I think, over the course of time. We definitely built something that worked. It could resolve the problem. We had hoped. One of the reasons we thought we might have been triggering this was because in the version of Airflow we were stuck on, which I think was 2.3.4 time.
Okay.
The clear task API endpoint didn't have a with downstreams option. It was added a bit later in. We built the general pattern at Monzo was that you would build a service that ran in our cluster that fronted your API so that you didn't have to keep connected to the API, which is totally fine. In our service, we built a bit of extra intelligence that would pretend the clear with downstreams option existed, but actually that was all implemented in the service itself. So we hoped that when we upgraded and we got the clear with downstreams, that would start to solve this problem to some extent. Because if you could make the task clearing process atomic, so you basically say, okay, all these tasks clear at the same time and the state is everything after the fact, rather than this kind of piecemeal process, we thought that would help. However, we upgraded to latest Airflow 2 and we still saw this problem occurring. There's clearly something else. Whether I don't, as I say, I've since left, but whether they've upgraded to Airflow 3 since then, I don't yet know. It'll be interesting to see if that solves the issue as well. But I think there's, but I think it might be something. The problem is, it's also hard to know exactly where the problem might be, because it may well be really deep down in the database drivers level. So it might even be not an Airflow issue at all. It'd be something to do with the database libraries. So it's something that it's very likely that something else will fix over the course of time. But obviously, you can't. But it's hard, because it's hard to identify exactly the root cause. Very hard to fix in that specific way.
This episode is brought to you by Astronomer, creators of Astro, the leading fully managed Airflow service designed for the modern data stack. Whether you're orchestrating large language models, implementing a data mesh architecture, or streamlining complex workflows, Astro empowers your team to focus on innovation, not infrastructure. To see how you can maximize Airflow's potential within your data ecosystem, visit www.astronomer.io.
Actually, I was a data engineer in a bank in France, and I know what it is when you have this issue that you can't reproduce for some reason, and it's just a nightmare. Because how do you know? How do you know exactly the root cause if you can't reproduce that error, and it happens like time to time?
And exactly when it's so public as well, because that was our other kind of big thing, was like all of these people, especially big execs, are looking at these data models and they're being like, why aren't they refreshing? And it ultimately comes down, when it comes down to, or it feels it comes down to your team, it's very difficult to be like, we know what the problem is, but we also don't. It's a very frustrating thing to not be able to give them an answer of, yes, we know, we're doing our work on it. Even on a sociological level, like, it's so much more frustrating than just a technical problem.
Yeah, I imagine that many engineers listening to us right now will feel you.
Yes, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure there will be a huge amount of sympathy, I'm sure.
So I guess, like you mentioned, that you built that external system to monitor that consistency. Maybe can you just maybe explain us a little bit more what it is, like what you actually?
Yeah, of course. Build? Yeah. So as I said before, because we effectively built the DAG in CI before, that made it a lot easier because the structure of the DAG, so the non-dynamic part, was very easy. We could get that. We actually stored it in BigQuery as a kind of big list of nodes and arcs. So that's very easy. Then, so what we would then do is we would take that static structure, and then you would make a few requests to the Airflow API to ask it for various different things. So you basically say, what tasks do you think have failed? So that's one set. And then what tasks do you think are in upstream failed? And that's the second set. And then essentially, you would take each of those upstream failed tasks and work back through the DAG and basically say, if I start from here, can I eventually find something that's failed upstream before I hit the root, and work through that for each of those upstreams? And if you find one where you can't, then you flag the DAG as inconsistent. In reality, you check all of them and then you give it a whole list rather than failing early, but that's the idea. So you're basically taking the kind of static information from that we'd already recorded, and then using Airflow to layer the dynamic information on top of that, and that's how you ultimately make the decision. Obviously, you could pull the whole DAG structure out of Airflow immediately. You could do it all through the Airflow API, but for various reasons, including the fact that some of our tasks were very big because they had these big JSON payloads attached to them for reasons that are very complicated. But basically, that was putting an awful lot of strain on the API itself. We decided not to go down that route and use this kind of pre-done version effectively. But the important thing was going to Airflow for the dynamic information, because obviously information you can only get from Airflow. And then once you've done that and you've worked out where the inconsistency lies, you essentially then, you perform a slightly different process where you work downwards and work out what's the minimal number of tasks I need to clear in order to get all of this stuff cleared. Because obviously, if you can get to something quite high up a DAG, it's got a lot of downstreams, the likelihood is you're going to have to issue fewer API calls overall in order to do that. That was the kind of system that we ended up with. And as I say, the first version of that, it basically just reported into Slack and just said, hey, the DAG's in an inconsistent state, clear these tasks in this order and you'll be fine. And then there was a kind of unattended mode, which we turned it into later on, which basically said, okay, that list I told you about, I'm going to now do that in this order, and that would just work unattended. Because the other thing that made this kind of more entertaining was that, or entertaining is the wrong word, but kind of frustrating is probably the better way of describing it, is that this stuff would always happen at 4 in the morning or some kind of really on. Yeah, because Murphy's Law, right? If it's going to happen, it's going to happen at the worst possible time. So it was the kind of thing where like any solution had to be either any solution basically had to be automated because otherwise you'd end up with these huge problems. So it started off as just a reporting mechanism and then moved on to actually then trying to fix the problem from there. So that was the sort of rough kind of order of operations it took.
This is super smart. Obviously, like I'm a huge fan of automating everything we can because ultimately that's the way to avoid becoming crazy, especially when you have like errors at 4 a.m. in the morning. Great. So I guess like moving on to again, like actually coming back to some scaling issues. So we talked about the DAG consistency, but obviously the UI is also very important. And again, we don't think about the UI that much. We always think about, hey, am I going to have enough like CPUs and memory to scale Airflow? Do I have the budget for that? And so on. But we don't think about truly like the UI. Am I going to be able to use the UI with the same way when I have two tasks than when I have thousands of tasks? To your point, actually, based on your experience, were you still able to use the UI, go to the graph view and then look at the tasks? Or did you have to build something on top of it? Or what was your experience with it?
Yeah. So the UI, for the most part, was pretty reasonable up to about 1,000 tasks or so. That was, I think, where the kind of limit started to show. So our big problems were things like some of them were really minor things, like the fact that the default number of runs when you click on a DAG is 20 is a real pain for some when you have 8,000 tasks, because obviously that's maths is terrible, but that's 16, there's 160,000 tasks. So it's trying to load up in this one kind of UI page. So that's a real pain because we had to have this, we had this like special run book. If you want to look at this, make sure this very specific URL, otherwise the web server might just crash because it's too big a thing to look at. So that's something that we had to do. The other thing were there were more problems when we were on a single instance Airflow cluster, because if somebody took down the web server, they took down the executor as well, which obviously was, you know, that's bad, but that's an architectural problem, which is something else. But you know, that's a bit different. But the other big problem that we had with the UI was that it's very hard in the UI to get across the scale and or cost of what you're about to do. So we had these incidents where people would like, they mixed up upstream and downstream. So they cleared a model with upstreams and all its upstreams rather than all the downstreams. And so really, that was a very expensive day for many reasons. But when you have, say, 4,000 tasks upstream of yours, because you happen to be downstream of whatever big model that you just want a bit of, for example, that's fine. But it's very difficult in the UI to communicate that's what you're going to do. It says, I'm going to clear all these things, but I don't think that, but it's very hard to communicate sometimes either the cost in terms of time or the cost in terms of actual money that you're going to spend doing certain things. And obviously when you're at a scale of 3 or 4 tasks, it's irrelevant. If you make a mistake, it'll only be a few minutes for that sometimes. But in this particular one I'm thinking of, I think that took us like 7 or 8 hours to recover from. And the person who did it was very apologetic, which is, it's not really their fault. They made an honest mistake, but the UI should have had better guardrails to be like, hold on a minute. This seems very odd what you're trying to do. Are you really sure that's what you want to do? Because that would have been helpful. And so actually on that similar point, we had to start restricting access to the Airflow UI for one. But we also started to build in extra approval levels, basically. So somebody else had to approve what you were trying to do. And we built that into a system that Monzo already had, which is called BizOps. And that has a very kind of extensible interface for if you approve things, then you can make certain API calls, so it makes sense. But it was really frustrating for a lot of the data analysts coming in when they were like, oh, I've used Airflow at all these other companies, like, how do I get access to the UI? And we were like, oh, sorry, you can't, because it's too dangerous. And that's even with reduced permissions models being what they are, it makes sense. But it was almost that they weren't granular enough for what we wanted to do, because you almost wanted it to be within DAGs rather than just like at the kind of whole DAG level and all that kind of stuff. So there were some problems around just like the amount of data the UI is trying to show you, and also because of the fundamental issue that the human's ability to visually reason about more than about 50 things is for the birds, basically. You're not, if you have more than about 100 things on a screen, it's very difficult to reason about any of it. So you instantly start trying to cut it down. And actually, to be fair, in the newer versions of Airflow, that was made a lot easier. But being able to, but then when you're at the level of our team, where we were saying like, how is the whole thing running? That's very difficult to get to. So that was where, as I was saying before, we had to start moving into the world of what do these visual indications and human intuitions mean in metric terms? And that was the big leap we had to make. But yeah, so we had, yeah. So a lot of the problems we had with the Airflow UI were basically just around the idea that it's not very useful at such large scale. And also it just was potentially quite dangerous for a lot of things that you could do with it. So those were the bigger issues.
This is super interesting because that's actually the first time that I hear that. And with practical examples. And do you have an example of what kind of permissions within a DAG you are thinking? Like, because you said that sometimes it's not granular enough. What kind of...
Limiting
the number of tasks that you want to clear, for example, for a specific DAG.
Yeah, or even some level of approval. If you want to clear more than, say, 50 tasks or something, then it's, hold on, you need X person to ping you for approval. Because lots of products have those kind of mechanisms built in nowadays. Things like Harness, you can do that with Slack integrations, Jira integrations, whatever you want. It doesn't have to be particularly heavy-handed, but just something that says, something that enables you to... Because it's all that thing about when you start restricting access to stuff, people, often the criticism you get is, oh, do you not trust us? And I think that's a very valid criticism to make. I think it's perfectly valid, but it's always the kind of trust and verify thing, isn't it? We do trust you, yes, but if you're going to do this, we really want to make sure you've got a good rationale for what you're doing, because that would have prevented so many issues previously. And I think that's the kind of view that we came to. But I think it's more the kind of all or nothing nature of the Airflow permissions you have. It's you either have all the permissions to do everything you need, or you don't. And there's no way of saying, we do want to give you these permissions, but we'd also just quite like to verify that they're actually okay. Obviously, for some people, it'll be fine to admin. That's totally reasonable. But for other people, it's we just want to make sure that what you're doing is actually what you think you're doing, because sometimes that's not immediately apparent from commands you can make. It's like,
yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And so you mentioned that you had to monitor some metrics, right?
So we started to think, essentially a lot of this came from the fact that we were struggling. People would come to us and say things like, oh, like, how healthy is Airflow? And we would say, it's running. That was about as good as it got. And so we really started to think about, like, okay, what does it mean for Airflow to be in a good state? Like, how would we know? And how would we know that without having to go through this sort of folkloric staring at the DAG, putting your finger in the air, it could be like, it's about this. How could we get away from that? And so we started to think about defining metrics, and then therefore you could define monitors on the back of it. And so for us, like, throughput was the really big, was the really key one for us. Like, how many tasks are completing, and what's that been like over the last kind of while? Because the thing that we found was quite hard was that often a lot of the underlying details of Airflow, or at least for us, were resided in other systems. Things like the Kubernetes cluster had its own set of metrics. BigQuery itself has a whole load of metrics you can come to. So there was a lot of kind of incidental things, but the big question we were asking was what rate are tasks completing, and has that hit zero? Is that a real problem? Because if the DAG is still processing, that's the starting point. And then for further refinements on that, you start to look into things like utilization, particularly of the underlying compute resources. So for us, that was like reservations in BigQuery was like a big deal. Less so on the Kubernetes end of things for us specifically, but I can imagine in other cases that might be true. How well are you utilizing all of the things? How are you utilizing all of the things you have? And between those two metrics was a pretty good starting point for what we were looking for. But I think the interesting thing was it was very hard to find a lot of guidance on that kind of thing. I would have been really interested to see like Airflow, the Airflow community coming up with, this is what we think a golden path looks like for decent metrics. Obviously, that's going to vary depending on a lot of specifics around Airflow. But I think it would be really interesting to see what the community would think in terms of, these are the metrics you really want to make sure that you're at least having thought about when you're thinking about monitoring. And then you can layer your own platform specific and all that other stuff on top of it. Because I think that's, because we had to, as I say, and to be fair, this is something that was starting up as I was leaving. So it's probably advanced a lot by now, but it was quite difficult to start from not very much, because coming from my kind of platform engineering background. So with things like Kubernetes, there are an awful lot of very opinionated views about these are the key metrics that you should care about. And that's really useful. So it'll be really interesting to see what that would be like in an Airflow context. I'd be interested to see what the discussion about that would be like.
Now, this is a very good point, because I feel obviously when you begin with Airflow, you tend to think about how I'm going to build a DAG, how I'm going to write a task and so on. You don't think that much about monitoring, right? Even if it is a crucial part of your work, you don't really think about that at first, but then you realize how important it is. And then this is when you realize that you don't have, to your point, that much guidelines on what metrics you should take a look at, even like what system you should set up to monitor Airflow. Obviously, you have some rules that you can find on the Airflow documentation, but to your point, it could be better. And I think this is a very valid point.
Because I think also it's a thing of, I think it's something to do with kind of audience initially, because a lot of the time with Airflow, you find these kind of organic installations have grown up over the course of time. So it starts off as one person wants to schedule a few models and they become successful, then it grows out and then suddenly it becomes then owned by the platform, by say a platform team. And suddenly you then end up with these very different expectations and very different needs, essentially, from what it is. When you're first setting it up, you just want to get it set up, and you just want to run your data, and you're not really that interested. But when it becomes, as you said, a critical piece of infrastructure, you actually care about, is it running well and all that kind of stuff. So I think it's very much a case of, as the audience moves, the expectations move with it. But it'll be, and therefore, it would be interesting to see almost maybe like differentiated documentation about, if you're running at scale, this is a different thing. So I think there's definitely something to be said for the audience changing and therefore the expectations changing as well. And I think that some of Airflow's history probably is some of the reason why that's the case, because even talking to other people who've run it, you see it running in everything from teams of 3 people to teams of 3,000 people. And those are very different things. But then, suppose it's to Airflow's credit that it can run at those multiple different scales, but it just brings with it different, expectations around what you're going to need to do if you want to run it for multiple scales.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And also, like, for the audience, you will find some Airflow best practices if you run Airflow in production in the documentation. Mm. So there are still like a lot of information that you will find useful. But yeah, to your point, it's again like very valid. Your expectations are not the same when you are a team of 3 than when you are a team of thousands, at least like 100 of people. So you definitely have to know what you should look at. I really enjoyed that conversation, but I still have a last one question for you, Jonathan. Honestly, I have many more questions, but we need to just a few. So looking back at your experience running Airflow with like thousands of tasks, I guess what advice would you give to teams who are starting to hit some scaling issues with their Airflow deployments? Based on your experience, what are your recommendations?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I think to cap the end of our previous conversation, so metrics are really important. Make sure that you set them up, go with what you think, track them for a while, and then when you start to have incidents, start to look at the metrics and start to work backwards and think, okay, what metric would I have needed in order to not have had this incident in the first place? And so it's definitely a kind of build up that operational excellence process and use the metrics to drive that. It's a really kind of important thing, I think. The other point is, I think it's really being clear about where and why you hit scaling issues fundamentally, like which specific component is it that's causing the issue? Because it's very easy to just say, oh, we're having problems with scaling, whatever. But be really specific about which part of the installation is the problem, and then start to think, how can we target stuff at this? And maybe it's the case that there's another tool that you need. Maybe it's more metrics. Maybe it's practices you need to adopt around the kind of things that I was talking about with approvals and all that kind of stuff. It's very much about being specific about where the scaling issue is, because very often it will be in a single component or maybe one or two, because most things will generally tend to scale in a kind of reasonable way. I think also the other thing is don't necessarily be afraid to build tools outside of Airflow if you need to. Like, it's kind of, obviously, I'm very much a supporter of open source, definitely go and contribute to the upstream because it's a great experience if nothing else, but don't be afraid to use the best tool for the job fundamentally. If the best tool for the job that's going to get you there quickest is building something external that can solve your problem, then that's fine. But if it also is going to contribute to the upstream and that kind of thing, then also go do that, because I think they're both important points. But I think the final thing I would make the point is that when you do hit scaling issues like this, sometimes it's time to look at what you're doing and think, why is this getting as big as it is? Because I think fundamentally, I think there are some times where we had this a couple of times at Monzo where people would come along and say, oh, well, what if we changed Orchestrator? What if we used Dagster? Or what if we used something else? And I would constantly say, maybe, but let's focus on the fact that this DAG is really big. How could we make it smaller? Because otherwise you end up in the kind of, I don't know, the kind of sugar rush of going to a new tool that's shiny and going to fix everything, rather than focusing on the actual fundamental problem, which is that some things are just too big. And so if you have a choice between new tools and root causes and breaking things apart and all that kind of thing, make sure the main thing is the main thing and split up the things that are big. Because oftentimes with scaling, you know what the problem is. Frankly. You don't necessarily know what the solution is, but you know at least know what the problem is. And so I think making sure that when you do hit scaling issues, make sure that you're focusing on the right thing and you're not trying to find some silver bullet somewhere, but you're actually focusing on how could I split this down and make it more composable and all that kind of stuff. I don't think you'll go far wrong in that sense.
Wow. I love that. Actually, to your last point, I think it's just like human nature. It's very easy for us to add new things. It's very hard to remove things that we've done. It's like we grow up. Go back small. So I guess it's just like natural to do things like that. But to your point, trying to find a new tool, which is very natural again for engineers. We like new things. Adding a new tool, adding new stuff, basically, sometimes it's not the solution at all. Sometimes it's going to add more complexity and it's not going to fix the root cause of your issue. So I love what you said. You really should focus on try to find the root cause and don't try to add new things and hope that it's going to be better.
And I think sometimes it's about, I think sometimes there can be a problem where it's about almost what can be palatable to your leadership in particular, because I think personally, it can be a lot easier to go to them and say, we're going to spend this money on this new tool and it's going to be brilliant and whatever else. And you can show them fancy demos and this kind of thing. I think the much harder sell and the much harder skill is to go in and say, hey, actually, if we spent the 6 months we were going to spend evaluating this on actually breaking this thing down, then we would have this many fewer incidents. I don't feel like that is necessarily as compelling, because ultimately a lot of technical leadership, we're also engineers too. But I feel like we really as an industry need to get better at selling the second version of that, because that's ultimately how we get scalable, sustainable software, which is what we all want. But I think sometimes we're not necessarily the best sales people for that kind of thing. And I think that's really important.
I think we're gonna end on that because it's perfect. It's a really nice way to summarize everything. Thank you so much for joining, Jonathan. It was a pleasure. I guess one last question to you. What is the best way to stay in touch with you?
Cool. Yeah. So I'm on X, Jonathan P. Rayner. It's Rayner. You find me there. I'm also on Blue Sky. I've just started there as well. So you can find me, Jonathan Rayner, on Blue Sky. And also, if you want to email me, you can email me jonathan@jonathan-rayner.com. All three of those ways you can get in touch with me. I don't necessarily talk exclusively about tech on most of those platforms. I also talk about my other interests, including baking and drumming and various other things. It's a whole smorgasbord of fun things you can come along and come on to enjoy. But I'm always open to conversation and I love chatting with people. So feel free to just open up either a DM thread or whatever on any of those platforms and I'll be happy to have a chat.
Wow. Thank you so much, Jonathan. Again, looking forward to meeting you maybe for another episode, but that was awesome. I really learned a lot and I'm sure that the audience learned a lot too. So thank you so much. Have a good one.
Thank you. Thank you. It's been great.
Take care.
Thanks for joining us for the latest episode of the Data Flowcast, Mastering Airflow for Data Engineering and AI. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned in today's show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you never miss an episode and leave us a 5-star review.